The latest news and analysis is brought to you every Monday to Thursday.
Live
in the Israel Update with Anthony Rutt, only on Chai FM.
Boker Tov, Anthony, how are you?
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov, how are you guys doing today?
Yeah, well, thank you. How was your weekend?
Almost forgotten, actually. We're kind of almost heading towards hump day on our side of the world,
having
already worked yesterday. So we're already well into our week. The weekend was good, nice weather. Even though it's winter time, we have had quite a lot of rain. We did have quite a lot of rain last week, the week before. Some records being broken for the amount of rain that's been received in a three-day period. Really astonishing amount of rain, but unfortunately still not quite enough to fill up the water sources that so badly need the rain. The Kinneret has risen in its levels, but unfortunately nowhere near enough to keep us feeling confident about enough water for the next summer. So I guess there's going to be some hope for some more rain soon. But in the meantime, some quite nice sunny days and, you know, good winter weather. Very nice indeed.
Fantastic. Anthony, let's get into some news. It has been a few days since we've spoken. And an IDF soldier was seriously wounded on Friday in a terror attack, which rounded off a particularly brutal week in which a number of terror attacks were carried out. So what are the details of the attack that was carried out on Friday morning?
So the Friday morning attack involved a Palestinian man who actually broke into an IDF checkpoint, an IDF location where the soldier happened to be located. And he attacked this the soldier at this military post. He wounded, he stabbed him, and he struck him on the head with what we believe was a stone. And this is really where the major injuries were caused. This soldier still continues to fight for his life. He's had to have some quite major surgery in order to deal with the head wounds that were caused by that attack. So we continue to pray for the safety and for the health of that young soldier who's really fighting for his life. He's been kept under sedation following the surgery that he had to undergo. And there is still hope that, you know, once he is brought out of the sedation, that he will be able to recover. But for now, at least, he's fighting for his life. And this, of course, follows the attack on Thursday in which two soldiers were killed, two soldiers who were guarding a hitchhiking point at Givat Asaf, also in the Judean Samaria area, two soldiers who were actually from the Haredi Netzach Yehuda battalion. And were killed when a terrorist opened fire. And, of course, that followed numerous other attacks, including that very, very brutal attack in which Shira Iran was shot while 7 months pregnant and unfortunately resulted in the loss of her child, who was then delivered by emergency cesarean, but unfortunately was not strong enough to survive the shooting attack and the very sudden emergency cesarean at a very premature stage of the pregnancy. So it was a very brutal week last week. And, you know, people are just reassessing now as to where we stand following those attacks. There was also an attack that took place in Jerusalem in the Old City itself. A man drew a knife and jumped on a Jewish man trying to stab him in the area of the Damascus Gate. Two border police officers who were nearby were also involved, and they were trying to stab him. Those soldiers were also attacked when he tried to stab them. Fortunately, one of them managed to shoot and kill this particular attacker. There were also a number of other attacks which we don't even really hear about. A car ramming attack in Albira, which is not far from Ramallah. Again, the attacker involved was killed by IDF soldiers at the location. So really a very, very intense week last week in terms of the number of attacks that were carried out.
Anthony, why do you think it has escalated over last week? Was there something significant about last week?
It's not clear exactly why there's been this escalation. There are a lot of dots that could be joined up. There, of course, continues to be the IDF operation northern shield that's being carried out on the northern border to uncover Hezbollah tunnels? Is that what's giving rise to a sudden escalation? Unclear, really. The fact that the Gaza border has gone slightly quiet, does that mean that the activities, the attacks are being shifted somewhere else? Perhaps it's got to do with the fact that the members of the Barghouti family were killed after having been involved in the attack on Shira Ishran and her husband and their unborn child at the time. And of course, the Barghouti family are very, very well known in the Palestinian / Arab Israeli context. Marwan Barghouti, of course, sitting in the Israeli jail, considered to be one of the main leaders of Fatah, but also the Barghouti is also quite closely associated with Hamas. So is that perhaps, is there backlash from the fact that that man was killed from the Barghouti clan? Unclear, really. Nobody really has answers to any of those questions. There is some speculation that maybe Prime Minister Netanyahu has bitten off a little bit more than he can chew by appointing himself as defense minister in light of the resignation by Avigdor Lieberman. And so there are people who are speculating that perhaps he's done not the right thing by taking on the defense portfolio and now having to suffer all of these terror attacks under his watch. There are no real answers to the question, Kathy, but you know, all we can really say is that the IDF soldiers and indeed the border police and the Israeli police in general are doing whatever they can in order to try to contain what is really quite a significant outbreak of violence that's taking place across Judea and Samaria in particular.
You know, it's so interesting because nothing in Israel is ever random. Everything's always connected. And so after the Ofra attack last week, there was also that... what was it? Givat Asaf. And I went and I started doing research into Givat Asaf because it seemed to ring a bell. And then I remembered it was one of the communities that had been told that they had to, you know, they had to demolish certain of the buildings because it was on Palestinian land or private land owned by a Palestinian man. And that happened. That happened long ago. But Givat Asaf was named after Asaf
Hershkovitz,
right, who correct. Lived in
Ofra. Who was a resident of Ofra.
Who, yeah, it's just like all these dots that are connected and nothing is random. And that's why I ask you the question, you know, why the escalation?
Well, I don't think, you know, it's true that nothing is random and that the dots do connect up. Sometimes the dots connect up sort of randomly but bring things together because, as you rightly point out, we've got this link between Givat Asaf and Ofra, named after Asaf Hershkovitz, of course, who was murdered. So the problem, unfortunately, is that very frequently the links that are drawn are links of tragedy, of people who've been killed, of people who are linked from one place to another and who have a connection. And I'm not always sure that the attackers necessarily are able to draw those links together, although, you know, the security forces are constantly looking for things, for lines that join the dots together in order to try to make more sense of what's going on in an attempt to try to prevent the next line joining the next dot. And that, I think, is really what this is all about, to try and see if it is indeed random or if there are links which can be drawn. And we have to draw those links very, very quickly indeed in order to prevent the links from being drawn going forward. And of course, you know, the lifestyle that's being led in the Judea and Samaria area for people who visited there, you'll notice that it is a completely different lifestyle from what you see in the central part of Israel. And the one thing that really characterizes the Judea and Samaria communities, which you don't see in the central part of Israel, is this whole culture of hitchhiking. Because the places are not near to each other in terms of walking distance or not within a city area. And because there are links between each of the different settlements and there are links between the settlements in the central part of Israel, people travel around there a great deal. And people, whether they be young or old, whether they be religious or not so religious, you find that they travel around there a lot. And many of them don't have their own private transportation. The bus services are okay, but not good enough to service the community that moves around so much and takes them to all the different locations that are spread out in that Judea and Samaria region. So therefore, this whole culture of hitchhiking is a big issue, is a big part of their daily lives. And what we saw last week was a real attack on this hitchhiking culture, with random gun attacks being carried out at hitchhiking posts. Many of the times they also double up as bus stops, so people come along to get a bus, and if you don't get a bus, perhaps someone will pick you up as they're driving past. And it is a very big family. People do pick each other up. People meet at the hitchhiking posts who know each other as you drive past. For those people who do have their cars, they very frequently know people who are standing at the hitchhiking spot. And so there's no hesitation to pick people up and take them along. The problem, of course, is that standing at the hitchhiking post exposes people to danger. And we've seen over the last week how those hitchhiking posts have now become completely different in terms of the level of security that's being applied. Huge concrete blocks have now been set up. Soldiers have been positioned at these hitchhiking posts to supervise the security at those posts, with their weapons drawn, with the bullets in the gun ready to be shot in the event that there might be a sudden attack taking place. You actually see soldiers with their weapons drawn all the time, pointing their weapons at the road constantly, even though there isn't a direct danger at that moment in time, but having to be absolutely ready for anything that could happen very, very quickly indeed. And of course, making sure that people who are at those hitchhiking spots don't go into the road, don't take unnecessary risks, don't go beyond those concrete blocks that have been set up in order to protect people who are sitting there and waiting for their ride. So it unfortunately is having an impact on the way that people go about their daily business, but there are very, very hardy bunch of people who are determined not to allow any of this to affect their daily lives. So let's hope that people will be able to go about their daily lives in a safe way. And, you know, thanks to our RDF soldiers who are really doing a lot of work in order to make sure that people can do that.
Very, very confusing that something, you know, that this decision may have been taken was news before it had actually happened. Secondly, okay, so the Australian government announced on the weekend that it's recognizing West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Doesn't it already recognize West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
Well, not formally. And, you know, we've been going through this whole issue of the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel for some time. And the most obvious way to recognize a capital is to locate your embassy in the capital, because that is the standard that is used in the diplomatic world, that that countries' embassies should be located in the capital of the country in which the embassy is located. And of course, in Israel's case, because of the lack of clarity in the international community around the status of Jerusalem, it has become the norm for countries to locate their embassies in Tel Aviv. And the reason for this goes really back to the 1947 Palestinian Partition Plan resolution that was presented to the United Nations, which called for Palestine, as it was then under the British rule, to be split into two, one for Jews, one part for Arabs, and for the city of Jerusalem to be a separate entity from the two states that could be shared by the two states but didn't belong to either of them and would be under some sort of international coordination. That was the plan back then. Now, as we know it, the Arabs decided to reject the partition plan proposals. The Jews accepted it. We have Israel today as a result of that. But the international community since then has never recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, simply because that resolution did not call for Jerusalem to be the capital of the Jewish state. But now we see countries and, you know, slowly but surely recognizing that Jerusalem is in fact the capital, even though when Israel declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, many countries said, hang on a second, that really goes against the United Nations resolution. So therefore, we can't support that as a unilateral action on the part of Israel. But slowly but surely, as the status quo has effectively taken people into understanding that really this is the fact and we can't change it. And also because of the fact that the Arabs back then really rejected the partition plan. So one of the most critical elements was rejected rejected right away. So Israel has continuously said, because the Arabs rejected the partition plan, you can't continue to hang on to the status of Jerusalem as part of that partition plan, as envisaged by that partition plan. And of course, the United States government in the form of President Donald Trump has really made that clear. And slowly but surely, other countries are following suit. And I think that the action by the Australian government is quite a smart action, because on the one hand, they are coming towards Israel in recognizing West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. They don't rule out the possibility in some point in the future of declaring that East Jerusalem could be the capital of a Palestinian state, although, you know, that certainly is not in the offing right now. And as we know, the city of Jerusalem is united and not divided into East and West. But the Australians have reserved that right for themselves to call East Jerusalem the capital of a future Palestinian state if they wish to do so. And I think the reason for that is also quite obvious, because Australia has very close links with the likes of Malaysia and with the likes of Indonesia and their local area, where they are big trading partners. In Malaysia and Indonesia particularly do not recognize Israel as the Jewish state, or even recognize the right of Israel to exist. Australia wants to try and play this both sides a little. Maintaining their relations with Indonesia and Malaysia is important. Maintaining its relations with Israel has some level of importance. Some cynical people have said, well, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has this very, very important primary that he needs to confront within the next few weeks. And there is apparently a very strong Jewish element involved in the vote that's going to take place in this primary, and that this action, not a primary, but a by-election that will take place, and the action to recognize West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is some sort of a ploy in order to try to buy the Jewish vote in that particular by-election. That remains to be seen. But be that as it may, I think that even though Israel has been disappointed by Australia separating West Jerusalem from East Jerusalem, I think that this is really a step forward. And I think that this is a real indication that that idea of a Jerusalem forming a part of two particular states, or being part of neither of the states, as was envisaged by the partition plan of the United Nations back in 1947, is really and truly dead.
Anthony, you know, at some point in the future, there is going to be a Palestinian state. And why can't they have East Jerusalem as their capital?
Well, first of all, this fact that at some point in the future there is going to be a Palestinian state is not something that we can envisage right now. Yeah. I mean, we have a de facto kind of Palestinian state arrangement because we have this Palestinian Authority, and they are effectively ruling over a piece of land, and they are ruling over people. So one could argue that there is a de facto Palestinian state, even though it's not formally recognized, not by Israel and not by the international community, or at least most of the international community. Does that mean that there will be a Palestinian state that will really take its place amongst the community of nations? I hope so. Because that will mean that someone has been large enough to stand up and say, you know what, we accept that this Jewish state, Israel, is along our borders. And the moment somebody has the guts to stand up and acknowledge and accept that formally and out loud, we will probably have a Palestinian state. So, you know, at the moment, unfortunately, we can't see that person standing up and acknowledging it. And we don't see that coming through the ranks at all. There seems to be this entrenched view that continues through the generations within the Palestinians that they will not recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And all the while that that is the case, I can't see a Palestinian state arising. So we'll just sort of park that for a moment and go into the idea of East Jerusalem as the capital of a Palestinian state. Now, you know, the point about East Jerusalem is that it contains holy Jewish sites, including the Kotel, including the Temple Mount, including parts of the Old City, which are really parts of Jerusalem that Israel will never give over to be part of a Palestinian state. So if you want to divide it along the east-west border that was in place until 1967. That is never going to happen. There was a concept that bits of East Jerusalem, sort of a little bit further out, could potentially be demarcated as being part of a future Palestinian state and the capital of a future Palestinian state. Har Choma, for example, was one of those areas back in the day that seemed to have been demarcated. It's now, of course, been populated with Jewish neighborhoods. And Israel is quite determined, and this is one of the things that that Israeli society in general seems to be quite united about, is that Jerusalem, the combined, the unified city of Jerusalem, is the capital of Israel, and that Israel will not give up bits of Jerusalem, and particularly not the holy sites in Jerusalem, to be the capital of a Palestinian state. That seems to go completely against the grain, and that would never pass a vote in this country, and that would really be something that would cause a lot of friction, if not a war even within Israel, because there's some very strong feelings about that. So whether you, when you say East Jerusalem, I think we need to be quite clear about what in East Jerusalem may form a part of a Palestinian state in the future, the capital of a Palestinian state. Potentially, there are bits of East Jerusalem that could be demarcated. Some of those Arab neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, perhaps so, but certainly not the East Jerusalem as we know it from the time until 1967.
Anthony Reich, you have got a fantastic way of explaining concepts and ideas. Maybe tomorrow, if it isn't too busy a news day, we can go through what it means when we talk about a two-state solution. Maybe
let's
that's what we can talk about. And I'm actually going to urge
people
our
in.
Yeah, I'm going to urge our listeners to grab a map of Israel. You know, where it shows Gaza and it shows Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, which is actually the West Bank of Jordan. Let's have that in front of you. And then Anthony's going to explain to us tomorrow what is meant by a two-state solution. And is it something that you would like to support, or is it something that you think, well, maybe there should be a three-state solution? You know, let's talk about that tomorrow, providing it isn't, it isn't too busy a news day. Anthony Reich, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you, and the same to you. And please do write in. Let me know what you'd like to talk about in terms of this two-state solution. I think in particular, what bits of it do people not really understand? I mean, the whole concept of a two-state solution has been thrown about so much. It's almost like rhetoric. When you say a two-state solution, everybody thinks that you understand immediately what that means. But when you really think about it, do you understand what the two-state
solution
envisaged?
What are the pros? What are the
envisaged?
Cons? Exactly. Exactly. I think that most people don't understand.
The idea of a two-state solution really goes back to Oslo. And Oslo is really and truly dead. So does that bit of Oslo really continue to exist today? And how have actions since then changed that? Can we take back what's been done now? You know, how do we take things forward? So I think there are a lot of concepts and questions which arise. But I'm interested to hear from you guys. And by all means, let's talk about it tomorrow.
Anthony Reich, thank you so much. It's always a privilege to speak to you. Are you still writing your blog?
I am still writing my blog, although I haven't been writing quite as proficiently as before, but there are some things that I have posted relatively recently. So feel free to go on and have a look.
Thank you so much, Anthony Reich. God bless. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.